Hi, and welcome to Kaleidos Science. Here you find answers about cognition that you may or may not have asked yourself. This episode is hosted by Elisa Palme. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode.
Short heads up before we start into this episode. This episode will only be hosted by me, Elisa, which mainly happened due to the reason that both countries, so Australia and Germany, had daylight savings between the date we agreed on recording time and day and the actual day of recording. We started the recording at 6 a.m. for me, which was quite early, so if I sound a bit sleepy, well, just bear with me. And with that being said, I hope you enjoy this episode and we're really looking forward to hear from you. During our life, we go through different hormonal changes that impact the way we experience emotions, our attention span, or our memory. Most of you probably still remember going through puberty and the changes that came with it. But there are also other changes that come with aging. Today we talk with Professor Caroline Gerwich about how hormonal changes impact our cognition. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Elisa.
Caroline Gerwich is an associate professor and deputy director of the HER Center in Australia at the Monash University and head of the Cognition and Hormones Group. And her research combines neuropsychological assessments with eye movement research to characterize cognition. And as always in our interviews, we start with a short get-to-know game where I give you 5 sentence beginnings, Caroline, and would ask you to finish them spontaneously.
Sure.
Okay, so our first sentence is, as a kid, I always wanted to be...
A dancer. Yes.
Did you do dancing from when you were little, or was it just a dream?
No. I not professionally, but yes, I did, you know, ballet and tap and jazz and loved dancing when I was growing up. I mean, I don't think I ever really wanted to be a professional dancer, but as a child, that was what I loved doing and thought that would be pretty cool to do that one day. It never even came close, but it was always a hobby. And yeah, I loved dancing and probably continued up until I'd had children, I think. I kept dancing. So yeah, it's something I loved doing growing up. And probably when I was quite young, thought, oh, that would be a fun thing to do as an adult.
Yeah. Our second sentence. If I was an emoji, I would be...
I'm probably just the boring, smiley, happy, plain one, you know, the yellow face.
Which one?
The one with the kind of the closed smile, yellow face that everyone uses. Well, that's the one I tend to use the most just because it pops up first on my phone. But it's, yeah, probably just the... pretty benign, plain, happy, not offensive, smiley emoji.
But the one with the open eyes or with the closed eyes?
No, open eyes.
Okay.
Just the plain smile. Yeah. Yeah, one of the first ones that was around, I think.
Yeah. The third sentence. My favorite thing to do on a day off is...
Ooh, lots of things. They don't tend to come around that often, but probably my perfect day off, probably some sort of exercise, going for a run or a walk, some sort of time with, you know, friends. I'm going to plan a whole day off here, maybe some shopping or something with my sister, and then family time, maybe a dinner, that kind of thing. So yes, I would make the most of it.
Yeah,
maybe like a bit of a walk, like a hike type walk as well. So a full day.
Yeah, sounds like a pretty good day.
Yeah.
Next sentence. Right now, I'm most fascinated by...
Probably the hot topic for me in my research that I'm really interested in is the cognitive changes that many women report during menopause, that concept of brain fog. Trying to understand what that is and why it's receiving so much attention, and also why around that menopause transition I'm seeing clinically and in research like a lot of women who are questioning ADHD, so really interested in what's going on with the brain during this time of hormonal transition.
I think we will hear a bit more about this later on as well.
Yes.
But before that, our last sentence is, I know it's time to call it a day when?
When I'm getting a bit sleepy, not really end of a work day, when I'm not really productive and I feel like I need a bit of me time, and yeah, work's not progressing. I'm sort of starting to flick through emails and put everything off till the next day, and I know, yeah, the day is done at that point.
Yeah. I feel like this is the most common answer we get.
Yeah. Yeah, keep going until it's, yeah, not yeah, going well.
Can you tell us all a bit about your scientific background? So how you came to what you're doing now, and yeah, just your history and background a bit.
Yeah, sure. So when I finished school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Maybe was still a bit interested in the dancing and drama kind of space, but also really loved science. So I did an arts science degree, sort of combining my interest in, like, you know, chemistry and maths and dancing. But when I got to uni, I started to really like the subjects, neuroscience kind of subjects. I loved physiology and I loved the sciencey aspects of psychology. And so I did an honours year in psychology, but specifically in neuropsychology, and did research into Huntington's disease and Parkinson's disease and found that really fascinating. And then after honours, I really enjoyed that, and I decided I would like to be a clinical neuropsychologist. So I did a doctorate of clinical neuropsychology, and my research looked at negative symptoms, which was a type of symptom that was experienced across a range of psychiatric and neurological conditions. So totally different conditions like depression, schizophrenia, Parkinson's disease, but they all presented with some symptoms that were a little bit similar, like apathy, a lack of sort of motivation and lack of drive. And I was interested in how these very different conditions might present with some symptoms that are quite similar. So I did my research component in that, and then I did clinical training as a neuropsychologist and really liked it. And then I did a postdoc looking at schizophrenia and cognition and different genetic variations that kind of contributed to different aspects of cognition in people with schizophrenia, and then started working with my now mentor and boss, Professor Jayashree Kulkarni, who does a lot of work in women's mental health, and she was working at that time looking at hormones and schizophrenia. And then I started to look at sex differences and hormonal effects in women across different life phases. And more recently, I've become quite interested in cognition and how that changes for some women during menopause, and also become really interested in how ADHD presents in women, particularly across different hormonal life phases. So, you know, now I'm working in women's mental health, and I'm still working clinically as a neuropsychologist and doing a lot of work clinically with women, not specifically just with women, but in adult mental health. But I tend to do a lot of work with women and who are experiencing different mental health and mental illness symptoms, and the intersection between hormonal life phases and a whole range of different cognitive and mental illness symptoms that people are experiencing. So, yeah, still really interested in a mixture of clinical and research aspects of neuropsychology.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think you already touched on quite some of the topics we will cover, and I'm really excited for that. Before we jump in, could you maybe tell us what hormonal differences there are between the sexes and how they change over lifetime, so we are all on the same page to start with?
Sure. So when we're talking about sex hormones, particularly in the context of cognition, the main sex hormones we're talking about are estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone. And most people have maybe heard of these hormones, and most people are aware that estrogen and progesterone are the female hormones, estrogen in particular, and testosterone is the male hormone. And so really broadly, estrogen levels are higher in females and testosterone levels are higher in males. So pre-puberty, they're pretty low, both estrogen and progesterone, and then they increase, and testosterone as well, and then they increase around puberty for both sexes. But then testosterone becomes higher, particularly in males. And then at some point during sort of adolescent years, it gets gradually higher and then peaks and then, you know, really gradually declines into older age. For females, it's quite a different story, so it's more stable in males. For females, there's the menstrual cycle, which is after puberty. Most females have a menstrual cycle, which is associated with regular fluctuations in estrogen and progesterone. And so the menstrual cycle is often described as having different phases. So there's the first half of the menstrual cycle, which is referred to as the follicular phase of the menstrual cycle. And during that phase, estrogen levels have a peak and then people ovulate. And then another hormone called luteinizing hormone peaks when people ovulate. And then the second half of the menstrual cycle is referred to as the luteal phase. And there's a smaller peak of estrogen in the luteal phase and a peak of progesterone in the luteal phase. And then there's the menstruation phase of the menses phase of the menstrual cycle. So for females who aren't taking any hormonal contraceptives, most females have a regular menstrual cycle and these regular fluctuations in hormones. And, you know, some women don't. Some women have quite irregular menstrual cycles. Some women have things like polycystic ovarian syndrome, which can be very associated with very irregular menstrual cycles. So there can be variations, but typically there's the menstrual cycle. And then for some females, there might be pregnancy, which is a time of quite significant hormone changes. And then there's the postpartum, so after pregnancy phase, when there's again quite significant hormone changes. And if someone is breastfeeding, that's also associated with hormone changes. And then later, after the end of the reproductive years, there's menopause. And so that's also associated with hormone fluctuations. So there's the lead up to menopause, which is called perimenopause. So perimenopause is a transition period from the reproductive years into menopause. And that's associated with fluctuations, even bigger fluctuations than the menstrual cycle, in our levels of estrogen and progesterone, as well as this overall gradual decline in these sex hormones, estrogen and progesterone. And then menopause is a single day in someone's life, and it's defined retrospectively, but 12 months after someone has had their final menstrual period. So that point is menopause. And then a female then becomes postmenopausal, and estrogen levels can continue to decline into the first year or two postmenopause, and then they're relatively stable. And there's more than one estrogen that circulates around our body, and so the particular estrogen that's higher in our reproductive years is called estradiol, and then a different estrogen called estrone becomes higher in our postmenopausal years. And then there's some other pituitary gonadotropin hormones. So these are hormones that are produced by a part of the brain called the pituitary, and they're called, I mentioned one, luteinizing hormone, which is associated with ovulation during the menstrual cycle. So luteinizing hormone and another one called follicle stimulating hormone, these two hormones increase after menopause. So for a female, there are quite a few significant times in a female's life where there are quite significant hormone changes. So really throughout an adult life or from puberty onwards, there are constantly hormone changes happening until postmenopausal years when the hormones are quite stable again. And gradually there's a gradual decline in testosterone in females as well across the lifespan, but not a significant decline at any particular time point, just a gradual decline of testosterone as well. So females also have testosterone, but to a lesser level than males, and yet it also gradually declines. So there are differences in sex hormones, but I think probably the biggest one is the fact that hormonal life phases are quite different in females compared to more of a steady state in males.
Yeah. I didn't know that the testosterone in women is also declining constantly. That was new to me. That's interesting.
Gradually.
Yeah. It's the same for men. So they're also gradually declining, and they don't have this abrupt shift or like this shifting phase as women with the perimenopause and menopause afterwards.
Exactly.
For them, it's more gradual, slow change, while in a female body, it's more really intense phase and then different hormonal state.
Yeah, exactly. And it's even more intense for some people who have, for example, like a surgical menopause. So for some women who might need to have their ovaries removed and suddenly they have a surgical menopause, well, that's a really abrupt transition from reproductive to postmenopausal immediately compared to the perimenopause, which can span about 10 years for some women. So it's kind of abrupt, but also over many years, there's these fluctuations and gradual decline in estrogen, estradiol in particular, and progesterone. So it's a significant hormonal change, but it can be over many years.
Yeah. Coming from the hormones, what cognitive abilities can be affected by these hormonal changes throughout the menstrual cycle?
Yeah, so there's been quite a bit of work looking at cognitive changes as well as emotional changes. So I think both sort of neurocognition, so when we think about cognition, we often think about sort of memory and attention and the ability to process verbal information. And then there's the ability to regulate emotions and recognize emotions. So both emotional aspects of cognition as well as neurocognition have been explored across the menstrual cycle. The changes in most people are pretty subtle across the menstrual cycle. So the general theory is that our verbal abilities, so the ability to remember things that we've heard, for example, remember words, remember stories that we've heard, those abilities tend to align with our estrogen. So at points in the menstrual cycle where estrogen is higher, so in the first half of the menstrual cycle, the follicular phase, there tends to be a broad but very subtle improvement in some of these verbal abilities. And then in the luteal phase where estrogen starts to drop and progesterone gets a bit higher, there seems to be slightly less ability in terms of the verbal domain, so less ability to remember words or retrieve words quickly. And then when progesterone increases in the luteal phase, there tends to be more emotional type symptoms that can get worse, but it's not in everyone. So it's pretty subtle at a group level, but at an individual level, some people seem to be just more sensitive to hormone fluctuation. So some women experience quite a few symptoms in that luteal phase, so in that premenstrual phase, and some women talk about, you know, a haze or a brain fog that they might experience, a sense of overwhelm, and quite significant mood changes in that premenstrual time frame that seems to go away within, you know, a few days of women menstruating. For some women, it reaches a diagnostic level where it's called premenstrual dysphoric disorder or premenstrual depression, and is really quite debilitating. So then they might experience quite severe depression for that time frame, and they might also experience that, you know, overwhelm and really struggle cognitively to concentrate, to process information. So that's a small subset of women. Depending on the literature you read, somewhere between 5% and 8% of the population, and will experience symptoms to that level where it's quite debilitating. But for the majority of the population, the changes are pretty subtle across the menstrual cycle. But yeah, the general theory is that it's the verbal abilities that correlate with estrogen levels, so higher levels of estrogen, and it tends to be associated with better verbal abilities.
Is there anything known to why some women might be more sensitive to these hormonal fluctuations, or is it up to debate, different theories?
Yeah, I would say it's still different theories, but the theories are there's some potential but not really well-established genetic components. So some women are just wired or predisposed to be more sensitive to hormone fluctuations across their whole lifespan. There's some theories about early life trauma and adversity. So for some women who have experienced trauma and changes to their hormone system that regulates their stress response, the HPA axis. It's called the endocrine axis, the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal. That's the endocrine axis that regulates our stress response. So for some people who've experienced trauma and that endocrine axis is a bit dysregulated, there's crossover with the hormone axis that regulates our sex hormones, the HPG, so hypothalamus pituitary gonadal axis. And so there's some theories and some evidence to suggest that people have experienced adversity in their life, and changes to their ability to regulate stress and stress hormones are also more sensitive to changes in other hormone systems, like the reproductive hormone system. They're probably the two key theories, but I think an important point to know is that when people do blood tests and hormone assays and measure hormones, there's no difference in the people who are sensitive to hormones and the people who are not sensitive to hormones. So there's no difference in the absolute levels of hormones. So we do know that it is very much about being sensitive to normal fluctuations in hormone levels. So not a difference in the underlying degree of fluctuation or something like that. So it's just that some women, for yet to be fully understood reasons, are more sensitive to hormone fluctuations across the lifespan.
And maybe that brings us to one of the next topics you wanted also to touch on, where you're also researching, which would be ADHD. And I've heard, I'm not sure if that's totally correct, but I've heard that for some women with ADHD, the hormonal, or they can be, tend to be more sensitive to these fluctuations.
Yes. Yes, there's certainly emerging research that has shown that, and we've had a look at that from a few different angles. So there's a bit of research that has interviewed women with ADHD to ask them about their experiences. And pretty consistently, the story is that a lot of women with ADHD are quite sensitive to hormone fluctuations across the menstrual cycle. So they experience a worsening of their ADHD symptoms in that luteal phase, so premenstrual phase before someone has their menstruation or before they have their period. So that seems to be a time when people experience a worsening of ADHD symptoms. Women with ADHD also seem to experience more emotional symptoms during that time. And there's also a little bit of research showing that for females who are taking ADHD medication, so stimulant medication, the medication is also less effective at that time point. So there's not a huge, vast body of research, but the limited research is pretty consistent. And again, it's not every female with ADHD who experiences this, but overwhelmingly a number of women with ADHD do seem to have a more hormonal sensitivity. And there's also higher rates of premenstrual dysphoric disorder or premenstrual depression in women with ADHD. So whether it is that they've got like a coexisting PMDD or whether it's just an exacerbation of ADHD, an exacerbation of mood symptoms, which are more common in people with ADHD as well, is yet to be fully understood.
Other things women with ADHD who experience stronger changes they can do, or is it mainly trying to get through the luteal phase if they notice stronger changes?
Yeah, I think just noticing is a really good first step, because I think a lot of women just don't notice. So some women just describe, oh, I'm generally pretty good for 2 weeks and then pretty bad for a week or two and then I'm okay again. And there's not necessarily a cognitive link made between hormones and ADHD symptoms. So I think for a first point is just being aware that menstrual cycle hormone changes might affect symptoms, might affect how medications work, might affect emotions. So I think that's a good starting point for women. And then I think it's always worth women speaking to whoever's medically looking after them about, you know, whether an increase in stimulant dose in the luteal phase might help. And there's a little bit of research that suggests for some women that can be beneficial. There's really no research looking at hormonal contraceptives and in ADHD and how that might help if there's, you know, a flattening of those natural fluctuations, whether that might help or not help ADHD symptoms. There's like one or two studies that have looked at hormonal contraceptives in broadly in ADHD, and they tend to show that it might be associated with a worsening of depression, but that was at a broad sort of population level. It was a Swedish cohort study. And so it was a bit unclear whether it was the switch between people taking the active hormonal contraceptive and then the sugar pills, and whether it was just symptoms experienced during that sugar pill, which is the inactive phase of the hormonal contraceptive, or exactly what hormonal contraceptive types, because there's lots of different types, whether that was making people more prone to an increase in depressive symptoms. So it's not really, hasn't really been explored whether that might be something. And then I think for women, it's just being aware and then being kind of kind to yourself, making allowances, not booking out your calendar too heavily in a week that might be a week that you're not feeling your best. And if you know that in advance, you might embed some more break times and some more structure and some more supports in that particular week of the menstrual cycle. And then if you've got lots of big demands, put those things at other points in the menstrual cycle where you know you might be functioning a bit better. So I think there's lots of different strategies that people can adopt. But I think the first thing is just, you know, being aware and taking note and noticing if there is a hormonal fluctuation component to people's experiences of ADHD or of mood symptoms.
I think one of the difficulties is that just in at least our medical care, that it has just long been, well, women's health, whatever, kind of this. And I think it's changing a bit at the moment, but still just how often I hear from friends also when they have quite severe symptoms and go to even their female health doctor or gynecologist, how often they say, well, that's normal, just get through it. And it's just insane.
I know. It's either dismissed or historically as well, women are often just excluded from research studies because people have got some awareness that, you know, hormones, menstrual cycle, pregnancy, menopause, they all might play a role. So it's easier just to exclude women. And then we don't really know how things affect men and women differently because it hasn't been researched, or how, you know, medications might have differential effects across menstrual cycle in menopause versus postmenopause. And so I think there's just so little research that the combination of women getting dismissed and a lack of evidence and information makes it a bit more challenging. But yes, as you said, I think it is changing, which is great.
Are there differences in the perimenopause and menopause between women with ADHD and without ADHD generally, or is it just again more on an individual level? For some it's stronger compared to others.
Yeah, so again, not much research at all in that space, but we've done some survey-based research, and about 80 to 85% of women in that particular study suggested that their ADHD symptoms got worse in that perimenopause transition phase. And then sort of anecdotally and from conference abstracts or from clinicians talking about their experiences with different women with ADHD, there's a general theory that ADHD can get a lot worse. Again, that hormone sensitivity idea across the perimenopause transition. And there's also been, again, this is more anecdotal than based in pure scientific literature, but there's also a lot more women who are presenting in perimenopause and questioning ADHD. So there's something about that perimenopausal transition that's either kind of uncovering or exacerbating an ADHD that was potentially always there. And it makes sense in terms of how we understand our hormones. Estrogen plays a role in the brain. It interacts with dopamine and serotonin, and we know that both of those, they're neurochemicals that are implicated in ADHD in the brain. So it kind of makes sense that if we have changes to our hormones that help regulate some of those neurotransmitter systems and they start fluctuating and declining, that it could, from a brain level, it could uncover or exacerbate an ADHD. But diagnostically, ADHD is something that is first there in childhood. It's neurodevelopmental. So even if the symptoms are only becoming quite apparent in perimenopause, there has to have been a history of those symptoms and evidence of those symptoms being there prior to the age of 12 for a diagnosis to be made.
Yeah. So just based on what you said, I think it intuitively makes sense to me that ADHD symptoms might get more apparent in the perimenopause, just because there's so much change in the body during that time that it makes sense that maybe old mechanisms that help to cope with symptoms of ADHD in the pre-perimenopausal phase might not work as good as they used to before. Is there any research if that's associated, or is it still totally open at this current stage?
It's totally open. We did a systematic review to have a look at what's been published in the menopause and ADHD space, and there's no research. So we are currently doing some quite detailed studies in that space, but at the moment there's no evidence. But you're absolutely right. I think there's a whole lot of potential factors that might be important. I think one is that there's the biological changes in our sex hormones that interact with the chemicals that are involved in ADHD, and so, or the neurochemical pathways. So I think that's potentially contributing. I think for some women who experience symptoms during perimenopause, not all women do, but for some, the symptoms of brain fog or the cognitive symptoms that can happen during perimenopause, sometimes they sound a bit like ADHD. So some people talk about difficulties, you know, retrieving words, forgetfulness, losing their train of thought, difficulties multitasking, difficulties making decisions. So those kind of symptoms are a bit like ADHD in some ways for some people. There's a bit of research that also says that there can be this new onset of executive dysfunction in ADHD. So executive functions are our higher order thinking skills, so our ability to plan, to organize, to monitor our behavior. And, you know, executive difficulties regulating executive function abilities is part of ADHD. So, but there's yet research in people, women who don't have ADHD, that can show that can emerge during menopause for the first time in some people. And then there's also the other symptoms of menopause that some women experience. So mood changes like depression, anxiety, irritability, there can be sleep changes. So all of those factors together could exacerbate something that was already there. Or as you said, it might also just be that women are also busy during menopause. They're stretched and they're juggling a lot, and whatever they may have been using that was helping them cope and manage and be productive and mask or cope with their ADHD symptoms, it just doesn't work anymore. They're just too busy, too stretched, too tired, too anxious, too irritable, whatever it might be. So I think there could be a whole range of factors that might contribute to why there seem to be a lot of women who are presenting with something that looks like ADHD or an uncovering of a pre-existing ADHD during those perimenopausal years.
Does it go back to more normal being less severe symptoms after the menopause onset? Look, the menopause is one day, so after menopause.
Yeah, in those postmenopausal years. So I think most likely yes, but we don't really know. And the same for the cognitive brain foggy type symptoms that not all women experience during menopause, but for the women who experience those cognitive symptoms during menopause, it seems to be that for most women, they bounce back. They at some point in postmenopausal years, and you know, in terms of the science behind it, it's thought that the brain adapts to having lower levels of estrogen in postmenopausal years, and so that's kind of the reason why the symptoms might resolve, because the brain's kind of got used to not having the nice effects of estrogen in the brain. And we haven't really talked about estrogen in the brain. Do you want me to talk a little bit about
yes, that?
So our sex hormones, estrogen and progesterone, they cross the blood-brain barrier and they have quite potent effects in the brain. And so we know primarily from animal research that these hormones act like steroids in the brain, and there are receptors or parts of the brain that respond to these hormones, and they're in brain areas that are really important for our cognition and our emotion regulation. So we've got estrogen and progesterone receptors in the front part of our brain, which is really important for our executive functions and our sort of higher order cognitive skills. So that's the planning, the organizing, the decision making, the monitoring of our behavior. And then we also have estrogen and progesterone receptors in the hippocampus, which is a part of our brain that's really important for memory, and in another part of the brain called the amygdala. So these are all in the temporal limbic regions of the brain, and that part of the brain is really important for regulating our emotions. And so these parts of our brain that are really important for emotions and for cognition respond in some way to changes in our hormone levels. So we know that estrogen acts in these brain areas. And there's some great animal research that also shows that estrogen has a big impact on our neurons in our brain, and it increases something called dendritic spine density. So the ability of our neurons to communicate with each other improves with more estrogen, and then reduces with less estrogen. And so estrogen is described as being sort of neuroprotective and having beneficial effects in our brains, and it also interacts with lots of other neurochemical pathways. So estrogen interacts with our dopamine pathway, our serotonin pathway, also our glutamatergic, GABAergic pathway. So these are all pathways in the brain that are really important for our thinking skills. And so there's a lot of animal research that's helped us understand that these hormones can have quite important roles in our brain in terms of cognition and in terms of emotions and emotion regulation.
Sounds a bit like less estrogen might also be then associated with some symptoms of cognitive decline.
Well, I think just in terms of sort of neurodegeneration and the role of estrogen, I think there is a bit of research. Certainly we know that females are more likely than males to develop Alzheimer's disease, which is the most common type of dementia. There's a little bit of emerging research that's questioning whether the hormone changes that happen at menopause, the drop in estrogen, the loss of those kind of beneficial neuroprotective effects of estrogen might contribute to the female risk, heightened risk of developing Alzheimer's, so in that sort of neurodegenerative space. So there is sort of hypotheses and emerging research that makes people question what the role of estrogen and loss of estrogen might be in neurodegeneration in females, or risk of mild cognitive impairment, risk of Alzheimer's disease. So I think that's a really important and interesting area of research, is better understanding what that role of estrogen might be across the whole lifespan, so right up to older age in cognition.
With the hormonal changes, is there anything that can be done with medication? So are there hormones women can take or that could support the changes they went through to limit some of the symptoms to influence positively?
So there is hormone replacement therapy, or in Australia we call it menopausal hormone therapy. So this is adding back in a form of estrogen, and if people still have an intact uterus, adding in a protective progesterone or a synthetic form of that as well. And at the moment people take HRT primarily if they have the traditional menopause symptoms, so hot flushes or night sweats, those vasomotor symptoms. That's what people might take HRT for. But there's lots of emerging evidence to suggest it might also be helpful for some of the mood symptoms that some women experience during menopause, and maybe for the cognitive symptoms, the brain fog. We just don't really know, and more research needs to be done. And then we still don't really know what the connection is between taking hormone therapy, HRT, during menopause and later life cognitive decline and dementia risk. So that's an area that I think needs a whole lot more research. There's certainly some evidence to suggest for some women it might be helpful to take HRT and in terms of helping reduce that risk of later life dementia, but there's other research that says the opposite. And so I think it's just that we really need a lot more research, because I think if HRT did help some women and reduce their risk of later life dementia, it's so important that we can understand that and know about that. We certainly know for women who have surgical menopause before the age of natural menopause, they're at a higher risk of developing later life cognitive decline and dementia. And for that subgroup of women, there's a little bit more research that shows those beneficial effects of taking hormone therapy to minimize and mitigate that risk of dementia later in life. And so we know that. And then for people who go through natural or spontaneous menopause, we just need to do more research to better understand what that link is between HRT use or hormone therapy use and later life cognitive decline or dementia risk.
Yeah. Would HRT be taken early in the menopause shift, or is it also same effect if it's taken later?
So in terms of cognition, the bits of research that have been done shows that the most protective effects is when hormone therapy is taken early, so during the maybe even perimenopause, but certainly close to menopause. And if there's too big a gap left between menopause and when people initiate HRT, perhaps it's less protective, maybe even having a negative effect on later life cognition, but we don't really know. But certainly the current research, based on what we know right now, the best time to take it is as close to menopause as possible.
I think one area we haven't really, or one area of interest of yours we haven't really touched on, is brain fog. We just mentioned it once or twice.
Yeah.
What is it and why?
Yeah, good question. And I don't think we even know exactly what the answer is, but that's something I'm really fascinated about. So brain fog is described as a whole range of different subjective experiences that women might experience during lots of life phases, and men might experience. Like, brain fog is just this lay term that talks about feeling a bit foggy in the brain. But in the context of menopause, the most common symptoms that people describe are forgetfulness, difficulties with word retrieval, you know, that tip of the tongue phenomena where you just can't find the right word. People talk about walking into a room and forgetting why, or it might be challenges making a decision, difficulties estimating how long different tasks are going to take, so that time estimation. So there can be a whole range of different symptoms. And most research shows that about two-thirds of women experience some degree of memory or forgetfulness around the time of menopause. People experience it across all life phases and all genders, but it seems to peak in that perimenopausal transition. And then there's a subset of women who it's more than just a subtle change. It can have quite a significant impact. So sometimes I see women who are really concerned that they might have Alzheimer's disease or dementia, and it's not, it's menopausal brain fog, but they're really concerned about their cognition. Some women are struggling at work. They might be sent for performance reviews, or they might leave work or switch to a lesser role at work because they're so concerned about their cognition. So it has really negative impacts on self-esteem. It increases anxiety and can be really quite awful for some women who experience brain fog. So it's a whole spectrum from no symptoms to mild, subtle symptoms to quite severe symptoms for some women. And in terms of sort of why and what it is, so it's definitely a subjective experience. We know that. In terms of the objective neuropsychological profile, so when we do neuropsychological assessment on women who are experiencing these subjective brain fog type symptoms, there's a subtle change. Most women still perform within the normal range, even if they're experiencing day-to-day brain fog. It's more subjective than it is noticed on objective testing. But there could be a subtle change in how efficient someone is in their verbal learning, so how well they can learn a list of words and later recall it. There sometimes is some higher level attention, working memory, so how well people can hold information in their mind and juggle that information. Sometimes there can be subtle changes there too, but they're still generally within normal limits, so not significant changes, but they're most significant at that subjective perceived level of cognitive challenge for people, so a subjective experience. In terms of why some people experience these cognitive symptoms, we don't really know, but our guess is that I often think about the brain fog cognitive symptoms as being like the tip of the iceberg, and there can be lots of things underneath. So I often think, not always, but there can be sleep changes. So it's, again, the other menopausal symptoms. So there can be, you know, poor sleep. So poor sleep at any life point leads to poorer cognition. There can be mood changes, and we know that for people who experience depression, anxiety, there can be cognitive symptoms as part of that mood spectrum of symptoms. Some people, and there's a bit of research that shows that people have more hot flushes are more likely to experience verbal memory problems. So that can happen, again, potentially because it's disrupting sleep, but at a neurophysiological level, there can be a link potentially, and some studies have shown a link between an increase in these hot flushes is associated with an increase in white matter hyperintensities in the brain, so some small subtle brain changes, and they have been linked to a subtle change in verbal learning. So it's kind of all, we're drawing inferences here to try and understand what's going on at a kind of a brain level, what's going on at a neuropsychological level. So there, I think there can be lots of reasons why women experience this subjective brain fog, but it is a real symptom. It's a common symptom, and it can exist along a spectrum of severity.
I was just thinking, I would assume it's also quite limiting in especially work, because usually when women start to get into the perimenopause, they are at a level in their work life where they have enough proficiency to take higher level positions. But then going through such a phase must be quite limiting in actually taking those positions.
Yes, it is. However, I just want to be really careful that we don't let this kind of discussion and talk end up damaging all the progress women have made in terms of gender equity in the workplace, because it doesn't mean that women are less able, because when we do our neuropsych assessments, people are still cognitively very able and offer so much, and that diversity is so important at a workplace level, but also for the individual woman, it's so important that they can be supported so they can stay in the workplace and they can thrive and they can offer all the expertise that they might be able to offer. So I think sometimes it's just the validation for women of knowing this is really common to forget words here and there, and here are some practical strategies that people can put in place to help. So it might be that you just want to reduce how much you're trying to juggle in your working memory, you know, write things down. So really practical things. It might be that you want to take notes in a meeting rather than trying to remember everything in your head. It might be that you want to use calendars and diaries to help structure your week, again, rather than relying on your memory, even if you were someone who was able to do all of that before. If you were someone who used to multitask, not that multitasking really exists, but if you were someone who used to juggle multiple things all the time, perhaps instead it's better to just try and do, you know, one thing at a time, finish that, then move on to the next thing. So lots of practical strategies that women can do. But yes, as you said, it can impact people's self-esteem at work, and it can impact their perception of how well they can do at work and their day-to-day experiences. But I think, you know, most women are still very, very able and aren't experiencing a strong cognitive impairment, but they might need some sort of support to ensure that they can, you know, thrive and not experiencing all those kind of self-esteem deficits and anxiety that might come with that experience of brain fog.
With all what we have talked about, what are general maybe recommendations or things that are known to improve symptoms that, or cognition, well-being that can be done?
Mm. Yeah, I think sort of menopause and midlife is a really great time for people to reflect on their lifestyles. And we know that now there are so many sort of lifestyle optimization or modification things that people can do to really make the most of their brain health in midlife, but also to ensure that they can do the best for their brains and their cognition as they age. So we have lots of evidence now showing the benefits of exercise. And I think it's really important that people embed some form of exercise in their life. And if they can try and aim, the World Health Organization suggests, you know, 150 minutes of moderate intensity, which is quite a lot, plus two weight or resistance training sessions a week or weight bearing sessions a week. So it's quite a lot, but I just think moving in some way is so important for mental health, for cognition, and for healthy brain aging. So I think that's probably a really important recommendation and something people can do. And then there's lots of research again about the benefits of ensuring you have good sleep. And so that's something that people can do to improve their cognition in the short term, brain health in the long term. And diet, there's, again, lots of evidence, like mainly for the Mediterranean diet or variations of the Mediterranean diet. So sort of cutting out, you know, processed food and making sure that there's lots of sort of nutritious foods that align with the Mediterranean diet in people's lives is also really important. Not using alcohol as a coping strategy, that's another one, because that's not going to be helpful for sort of long-term brain health to drink lots of alcohol, and doing what you can to minimize your cardiovascular risk. So talking to your doctor about, you know, blood pressure and, you know, bad cholesterol, and just making sure you can kind of keep your cardiovascular health. It's the same as brain health. So keeping all of those things at their optimal levels if you can. And social connections, another one that's getting more and more evidence how important it is to be socially connected, which is always, you know, a great excuse to make sure you catch up with your friends and feel connected in some way socially to family and to friends. That's really important, again, for brain health and building cognitive reserve and cognitive capacity, and making sure we stimulate our brain. So whether that is listening to podcasts or reading or, you know, learning new hobbies or whatever it is that you might enjoy to keep your brain active is also really important. So I think there's, you know, lots of things that people can do to try and improve their brain health. And there'll be short-term immediate benefits that people experience from a lot of these lifestyle things on how they feel and their well-being generally. And then there's also the longer-term benefits that people can experience as well from changing some of these things in their lifestyle, or continue, if they're already doing them, just continuing to do those.
I think it's quite soothing to hear that it's just the normal general recommendations for a healthy life.
There's nothing.
It's nothing special.
Nothing special. And it's the same, you know, heart health, brain health, cognitive health, mental health, they're all the same recommendations. It's not as if there's one thing that you have to do and then you have to remember another 10 different things to help your heart. It's all the same thing. All of those recommendations apply to our whole bodies and our brains and our minds and our well-being.
Yeah. So since we started off as a cognitive science podcast, we always ask our guests at the end of our episode what cognition or what role cognition plays in their research.
So it's a central role in my research, I feel like, because I research so many aspects of cognition, it's very important, and it's something I consider in all different aspects of research. So if I'm doing research into depression, I would always include cognitive measures because I think it's so intertwined. And if we're doing research into sort of lifestyle things, again, I always try to include some sort of cognitive measure, both at a subjective and an objective level. I think they're separate things, but really both equally important. So I think it's really important to measure someone's subjective experience, for example, of brain fog, but just their subjective experience of day-to-day memory, day-to-day attention, day-to-day executive function capacities, and then also at a neuropsychological objective level to get a score on a test of memory or a test of attention or a test of executive function. So for me, it's really important to measure that in lots of different areas. I think it plays a critical role in our lives and in all aspects of my research. So I think cognition is central and very important.
And if someone has listened to this episode, which would be something they should definitely remember in one or two sentences?
I think just to have a broad appreciation that particularly for females, there are lots of life phases where our hormones change, and some people are sensitive to those hormone changes. So if you're out there and you're someone who suddenly started experiencing depression or cognitive symptoms, and perhaps there's a cyclical pattern, or perhaps you've started a new hormonal contraceptive and you've noticed some changes, or perhaps you're going through perimenopause, which can start in your early 40s, that maybe there's a hormonal reason that might be contributing. So I feel like that was more than a sentence, but yeah, that's my message.
I mean, it was one or two sentences, so that's totally perfectly fine.
Okay, good.
Thank you so much for talking to me today and for taking time.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure having you.
Thank you, Elisa. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me as well.
This was Kaleidoscience. We hope that you enjoyed this episode, and we would love to have your feedback. You can rate our podcast and give us feedback on our Instagram account. Have a great week, and you'll hear from us again in 2 weeks. This episode was hosted by Imogen Hüsing and Sophie Kühne. Produced by Imogen Hüsing, Clara Kühne, Sophie Kühne, Sönke Lülf and Elisa Palmer. The music is from Jan-Luca Schröder, and the logo is from Annika Richter.